Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Plains on the Prairie podcast. I'm Max.
And I'm Sam.
And we are coming back with you guys with another episode of our Minnesota Aces series. What are we up to?
We're up at seven now.
Minnesota Aces. And how many did we have for North Dakota to put you on the spot?
We had 12 total.
12, gotcha. But obviously, I know we've talked about in the past that we have quite a few more Minnesota Aces than North Dakota.
Most definitely.
Yeah. We're still rocking and rolling. Today's episode is going to be covering the life and career of U.S. Navy Captain Herbert N. Hock. Kind of a very German last name. So if we're like kind of stumbling around with how to pronunciate it.
It might be Hauk. It might be Hock. I don't know. We'll figure it out.
Absolutely. Again, kind of just a preface, a lot of these World War II aces, we just don't have a whole lot of information on their early life. Most of it either covers, you know, their military career and then, you know, what they did post-World War II.
Well, if you guys remember from the North Dakota series, we kind of started that based off of a display we have here at the museum where we make all these podcasts. There's a whole wall on North Dakota aces. I mean, we did find some more on top of that, but there was a lot of the legwork done on the personal life and stuff like that. So we had a lot
really
of help.
Spoiled us with information.
So. Yeah, and that was made, you know, 20 years ago.
Right.
So there,
a lot of those guys. Some of them were still alive.
Yeah.
And I think someone had said that some of their family members would come in. Like I think. Who was the P-47 pilot who was killed?
Oh, Olson from Fargo here.
Yep, his sister came in and provided.
Really?
Yeah. Dennis was telling me that his sister came in and talked to Dennis for about an hour about her brother, which is really cool.
Awesome.
Without further ado, we'll hop right in. So Herbert was born on April 2nd, 1915, in Corona, Minnesota.
Correct me if I'm wrong, I believe it's on the way from, if you go up 35 on the way to Duluth, I believe it's kind of up north a little
bit.
So we were kind of deciding, trying to figure out who to do, you know, for the next podcast. And we've kind of been doing the Army-Navy stagger. But then we also are like, oh, most of these guys are from the cities. Let's mix it up.
And, go from, you know, someone from the Iron. Well, I guess that's not quite the Iron Range. Not quite there yet. But no, really, you know, I think we haven't really looked if any of our guys are from Duluth or any of that area.
Yeah, probably one or two in there. But
hopefully.
We know one from Superior, and most of you World War II enthusiasts do.
Yep.
but maybe in a different series. So.
Yep, so then Herbert attended the University of Minnesota from 1933 through 1936. And I think it's kind of, I guess he didn't commission because he would have joined in 1936. And then was assigned to VF-9.
Yeah, and VF-9 wasn't into being until World War II.
Oh,
so
really?
I spent a lot of time looking through. So those of you who know, I'm kind of a pre-war nerd a little bit. There's not many of those, I know. But I was digging through all my U.S. Navy between the wars stuff. Couldn't find really anything on him. I really don't have much for squadron rosters of, you know, VF. You had VF-2 through 7 at the time for all the way up to World War II with the different carriers, because back then, you know, everything up to the Wasp pretty much, and then the Hornet came slightly later, so couldn't find anything, unfortunately. But then, he was assigned to VF-9 during the war.
Gotcha. So, kind of an interesting tidbit, even before he entered combat, he was involved in a mid-air collision on June 30th, 1943, over Pearl Harbor while flying an F-6F Hellcat. He, fortunately, was able to bail out, unfortunately, the pilot of the other aircraft, did it say it was another Hellcat?
It was another Hellcat, and didn't find out if it was like with the same squadron or anything like that, but it was a training accident. Didn't really delay him all that much on his recovery or anything. Didn't get, you know, back then things happened.
Yeah.
It happened a lot. There was a lot of training accidents, whether it was single plane or midairs. Didn't happen near as often, but they happened. And you weren't really, unless you were blatantly doing something, you weren't really reprimanded for it because it was just part of the game.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah. That's a perfect way to sum it up is, again, you know, even today accidents happen.
Yeah.
And it's just, one of those things about flying that, you know, you always keep in the back of your mind. So he embarked on the USS Essex in September of 1943, bound for the Pacific. And on November 11th, so veteran, or I guess Armistice Day, 1943, Hawk joined other members of VF-9 on a strafing run over Rabaul, and later in that same day led a flight of Hellcats against a counterattacking force of Japanese fighters, where he was credited with downing three aircraft. All in one day, that's, and I assume, were those his first three kills?
They were, to like my knowledge and just through the research. I'm sure you probably came to the same conclusions. But this was, the USS Essex really embarked on this island hopping campaign, just like the whole doctrine of the U.S. Armed Forces in the Pacific. Rabaul was one of those islands that was not attacked on land. We didn't land any troops there ever. We isolated it and bombed it into submission, pretty much. And at this time, you know, you had combined forces, U.S. Navy fighter support. You had P-38s coming from New Guinea. You had a bunch of B-25 and A-20 bomb groups coming from New Guinea as well. And Rabaul was kind of a hornet's nest at the time. It still was very much alive. I mean, yeah, we've talked to those of you who have been listening to our podcast more than a couple episodes have heard us talk constantly about the training tactics of Japanese the Japanese Navy and Army versus the U.S. Where, you know, at this point, yeah, Guadalcanal was done. They're pretty much the cream of the crop was gone for the most part for their pilots. So yeah, you could say it was outmatched, but they still had plenty of fighters. I mean, they were never a defeated force until they were surrendering.
Yeah, exactly.
So, and most likely, just based off of Rabaul being a naval base, most likely zeros that they encountered here.
Gotcha.
A6M2s or 3s.
Well, we should mention that that action of him shooting down three aircraft earned him the Navy Cross. I know I found his citation online.
Yeah.
I can't remember it from memory, but if you're interested, give that a look up, because it's pretty fascinating. On February 16th, 1944, Hawk led VF-9 on a strafing attack at Truk Atoll, accounting for six planes destroyed on the ground and 27 total destroyed by the squadron as a whole. 21 of these Japanese aircraft were shot down by the squadron that day, with two being shot down by Hawk himself, bringing his total up to five confirmed victories, making him an ace. Later that day, he led the squadron again on another escort mission for this time dive bombers and torpedo bombers back to Truk, and also hitting the ground targets once again.
Yeah, so that was 27 ground destroyed plus 21 in the air by the squadron.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, that's what I got out of it and looked up some action reports of it. So 48 aircraft accounted for, destroyed, many damaged as well, by one squadron.
Wow. And so, he led that attack.
Yes, and then he went up later.
Yeah.
So Truk was, at the time, so Rabaul was another, was a major Japanese base. Truk was the next one that was to get isolated and kind of cut off from the rest of the Japanese forces. So again, another concentrated area of Japanese aircraft. So for them to be able to inflict this much damage is quite impressive.
Absolutely. And we should mention that he was awarded a second Navy Cross for his actions that
day. We have a little theme here.
Yeah. So on April 7th, 1945, Hawk and VF-9, I would say that this is probably the most impressive action, not just for Hawk, but for VF-9 as well. They escorted torpedo bombers on a mission to find and destroy, you might have heard of this ship, kind of famous, but kind of underrated, the Yamato. Did I say that right?
Yamato,
thank you. You might not have heard of it. It's not a famous battleship at all or anything.
I haven't heard of the Yamato.
Yeah.
No, if you're a museum goer here in Fargo, and at least, especially if you were around back, you know, within 10 years ago,
yep.
Stu Bass, a guy we're going to be discussing on the podcast.
Absolutely.
At some point, was also involved in this. So you might know it from there too.
Yeah, for sure. That's one, being at the museum for so long, I've always, heard stories of, former members and Dawson's who have passed away. And Stu is up there among some of those that I'm probably the most sad that I never got to meet. Just seemed like such a great guy.
Yeah, and we'll definitely run a special on him because, I mean, he's the reason I'm here in this chair right now.
Absolutely.
So.
So Hawk and the rest of EF9 led the bombers towards the ships that sank the Yamato and the heavy cruiser. Yeah, wow.
Yahagi. There we go.
Thank you.
So he definitely led Stu.
Mm-hmm.
So those of you who don't know, the Yamato is the largest battleship at the time.
Oh.
And I think still.
Wow.
So those of you who know the Japanese, they lightly armored their aircraft and their tanks. Their ships, they were a different story. Yeah, they put all of their metal into the ships. The Yamato was a ship that was around for the majority of the war, but this was a last-ditch effort by the Japanese Navy. It was their kind of last bonsai attack, basically a suicide. It was a suicide mission of all these ships towards Okinawa to disrupt shipping. And the U.S. caught wind and said, all right, we're going to send some torpedo bombers, dive bombers, and just get them. And that's exactly what they did.
Cool. So obviously we'll talk more about this when we talk about Stu, but his torpedo squadron was flying Avengers that day.
Avengers from the same exact carrier.
Really?
Yep. Wow. USS Yorktown. So we'll get into we'll talk about the different carriers when we talk about the squadron history, but they were on the same carrier, so I'm 100% sure they crossed paths.
For sure. Yeah. That is super cool. Because again, we'll talk about this more when we cover Stu. But what did they sink? One of the escort destroyers for
one of Stu's torpedoes was after the Yahagi.
Wow!
So
that is awesome.
Yeah, and he got his own Navy Cross from that day too. Yeah. So we'll definitely be talking about that.
Well, keeping with the theme, Hawk was awarded his third Navy Cross for that action. So
I've never seen someone win three Navy Crosses.
Is unbelievable
that we've covered. So
like. Yeah, just a very impressive career. Post-war, we should mention he scored a sixth kill, but we were not able to find any information on that. Likely was probably, I don't even want to speculate because...
Just happened sometime, but again, not documented, unfortunately.
Unfortunately. So Hawk remained with the U.S. Navy post-war and made it achieve the rank of captain in 1956. And would later be the skipper, is that what?
Yeah.
I don't know Navy jargon, but would be the skipper of the USS Shangri-La from 1960 to 1961, and would serve through probably some of the darkest days of the Vietnam War, retiring in 1968. Not a whole lot is available on his post-military career life. We do know that he settled in Florida and passed away on February 24th, 2002, in Cape Coral, Florida, at the age of 86. Wrapping up that, when I was Googling, research and all that, this guy had a New York Times article.
Yeah.
This guy had, L.A. Times, huge covering for his passing.
Yep.
Normally when a World War II vet passed away, from what I've seen in our research, the obituaries was just, Fargo or where, their respective towns. But the New York Times one caught me completely off guard.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I was hoping that would have revealed more information. Of course, it's behind a paywall.
It's behind a paywall, but I did get through it.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Yeah, I got through it. anyways, make sure you pay the paywall. It was...
You paid fair and legally is what I'm hearing.
Yes, very legal. The article was, again, pretty much every article you'll find on him is about the Yamato, which is great.
I mean,
it's a cool story, and they tell it well. They're journalists. I don't think we're quite journalists,
right. But,
your English major would help.
Yeah,
but,
I think, don't get me started on modern journalism. As long as I'm not writing for... forget it. I'm going off tangent. What is it? BuzzFeed.
There we go.
Yeah.
So we, very, very dense career during World War II. Unfortunately,
absolutely.
We couldn't find much, but he did captain a carrier by the end of it. So
it's very, very cool. So now we'll get into VF9 history. So VF9, like several of the squadrons we've covered so far, was not a pre-war squadron. They were stood up... on March 1st, 1942, at Naval Air Station Norfolk, and were part of Carrier Air Group 9, on board the USS Essex. What you said it before we started recording, but what squadrons were pre-war, and then what, like, was it VF-1 through 7?
Yeah, and VF-1 kind of petered out with the Langley. So how the squadrons worked initially was VF-2 would go to CV-2, which is the Lexington, and so on. So 3, 4, 5, 6. And then VF-9 was supposed to initially equip on the USS Essex, which was the CV-9. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of how it was supposed to work at first. And eventually, carriers would... They would mix around. Yeah. I mean, some carriers were sunk, like the Lexington, like the Wasp and Yorktown and all that. So there was some changing around eventually, and that was inevitable. I mean, but that was the original organization of the Navy.
Gotcha. I'm glad we have someone that understands that on the podcast, because Navy carrier groups and stuff completely go over my head.
The girlfriend loves me discussing this.
They were originally equipped with Brewster F2A-3 Buffaloes and then quickly reassigned to Grumman F4-F3 Wildcats in April of 1942. Later that same year, in August, the squadron was attached to the USS Ranger to support Operation Torch. That is cool.
It is cool.
for those that aren't aware, Operation Torch was the first action by the Americans in Europe.
It is.
Landing in North Africa. So that's, and you really don't hear much about the Navy action in Europe. Obviously, it's more dominated by the Army Air Force. I know you have a picture of, a wildcat attacking a couple of French planes.
They were VF-41, which was also on the Ranger at the time.
Really?
So I got a few Operation Torch items if you guys want to, if you need any book links or anything like that, just let me know.
Very cool. So they were reattached to CAG 9 later in November of 1942 and re-equipped with Grumman F6-F3 Hellcats in February of 1943. And a couple months later, it wouldn't have been a couple months, it was just the following month, they embarked on board the USS Essex to Pearl Harbor and then later set sail for the Pacific in September of 1943. So spent most of 1943 arming, getting re-equipped,
getting
acquainted, and then heading out. So VF-9 participated in multiple engagements in the Pacific. Like you said earlier, really instrumental in that island hopping campaign. I have to ask, you mentioned with the USS Essex, was it normal for other carriers to do the island hopping, or was the Essex kind of unique in the sense that it was always going to like whatever island they were bypassing?
No, they were attached to a task force. You've probably heard of Task Force 58, which was huge in the Battle of Philippine Sea and pretty much all the Marianas part of the island hopping campaign. But yes, during the early part of the war, carriers were they were in task force still.
Yeah.
They were much smaller. The U.S. industrial capacity, though, was huge, right? That was the biggest potential, the biggest factor for the U.S. was their industrial might, and it eventually just took off, As soon as we were into the war, it exponentially grew.
Because, again, to put you on the spot, do you know what the number was for how many, obviously not like a massive carrier, but like how many escort carriers were they able to
produce? I don't even know, but the CVs were up into the 50s at the time. Wow. The CVEs there's a bunch. There's so many groups out there that I know a little bit about the early war, but
planes on the prairie, we're not ships on the prairie.
We really don't. There's only one ship on the prairie I know, and that's down in Omaha. So
no.
And it's a submarine.
Oh well, it doesn't something. There's like a tower off a sub in South Dakota.
I suppose. Yeah.
I think so.
Yeah. Yeah, but we're planes on the prairie. But yeah they were. the Essex was part of many other carrier, or like part of a group, and they were notable for attacking Rabaul, the Gilberts. That was huge for air support during Tarawa, which was a huge battle for the Pacific, a very bloody one.
Yeah, if you study World War II but don't know the Battle of Tarawa,
what are you doing?
You gotta read a little bit more.
Yeah, and then they also took part in some of the Marianas, including Saipan, Guam, and Tinian, and also cutting off Truk. So yeah, very notable career. And then they were later, at some point in this point, I couldn't find exactly time-wise when, they were attached to CV-16, which is the second USS Lexington. And then finally the second Yorktown, CV-10, which again will cover a lot during Stu. Mm-hmm. So, and it, something notable, also the bombing and torpedo squadrons of the same number were equipped to the same carrier. So again, very likely them to cross paths on multiple carriers. But they were attached to Yorktown. They were, that was when they were part of the air support over Okinawa and the famed attack on the Yamato. So then eventually the squadron returned stateside shortly after Japan's surrender and was actually deactivated pretty soon after the war on September 28th, 1945.
Yeah, that is
soon. So if you guys remember, those of you who listen to the North Dakota series, a lot of those squadrons are wartime-only squadrons. So a lot of the VF-7s and 8s and all that. This is one of our first squadrons that was deactivated shortly after the war in our Minnesota series.
Yeah.
I believe the only other one was the 28th Aero Squadron from last week.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, and they don't... Yeah, I don't think any... Like the 28th Bomb Squadron, which I believe is at Ellsworth, they don't share the lineage at all.
No.
Yeah. So,
yeah, well, unfortunately...
Yeah, we couldn't really find warbird survivors. Again, you know, all the Navy planes look so similar.
Yeah.
At least the fighters. Obviously, I know that, you know, there's some differences between, like, Avenger tails, mm-hmm. depending on what squadron they were assigned to and whatnot, but...
Well, if you want, there is an F-6F Hellcat pretty close by to us here at Granite Falls, Minnesota. Very beautiful restoration. There's plenty of other Hellcats around. We did cover a lot of them in the North Dakota series, too.
Do you remember what, because I forget his first name, but McPherson, the ace.
Don McPherson.
Don McPherson, thank you. Because I know the Fagans have their Hellcat painted up in his markings. Do you recall what squadron he was with?
I want to say 15, but I might be wrong.
Okay.
Or no, 15 was Mincy. That was Clarence Borley when we talked about him. But yeah, unfortunately, it's kind of slipping my brain. But plenty of Hellcats around. This is actually our first Hellcat ace of the Minnesota series, where that was about half of our aces during the North Dakota series. So, again, we're very fortunate to have some variety here, and every story has been amazing so far.
Absolutely. Well, I think that wraps it up for this week. Thank you guys so much for tuning in. We're excited to bring you our next episode next Monday.
Yeah, we got plenty to churn out. So
yeah, absolutely.
All right. Well, thanks, guys. We'll see you later.
Take care.